So welcome to the Commons Page podcast number 7, directly from iCommons meeting in Dubrovnik. With me here is Cory Doctorow, and Cory Doctorow is an author, a science fiction author. He's a copyright activist, or we can say a copyright reformer, and he's also co-editor of Boing Boing. And I'd like to talk with Cory about how he uses Creative Commons licenses for his work and how his experiences are. But before we start, maybe you can say something about your background, please.
About my background? I'm Canadian, I had a fairly erratic education. I never finished university. I spent 7 years in gymnasium, and then dropped out of 4 universities, and then founded a software company eventually, moved to San Francisco, went to work for Electronic Frontier Foundation, went to be the European director of Electronic Frontier Foundation in London, retired to write books, then got an offer to go on a Fulbright to Los Angeles. I'm just finishing my year in Los Angeles, moving back to London to write books some more.
So when you listen to representatives of the classic media companies, they always say, no, we need a very strong copyright because that is the only source of how can creators or authors or musicians, filmmakers can make a living. And if you copy illegally, that is theft and that is piracy and that is bad. So now you as well, you publish with a major book.
Von Holzbrink.
Yeah, that's a big German media player. So, but you as well give it away for free on the net. So why on earth did you do that?
So I had a lot of reasons for doing it. I'd say that my first intuition was just that people were starting to copy science fiction books on the internet without permission. Copying books is hard. You have to scan every page, then you run them through optical character recognition software, and you clean them up by hand and find all the typos. Slow. I tried it once. It took me 80 hours, you know. With practice, probably 10, right? But the first time, 80 hours. And I had to destroy a book. Had to cut the spine off to do it. It's very slow. So I thought, if someone loves my book enough to spend 80 hours on it, I'd rather that they spend it promoting the book than figuring out how to make a copy that won't be as good as the copy I'd make. So make some copies, right? Here's a canonical text, much cleaner than your text that you would ever make from the book. Just go copy it. Share it. Later, I came to understand more about what that intuition meant. And in the last few years, I've been trying to kind of come up with a better theory about how this all works. Tim O'Reilly from O'Reilly Books, he says that the problem for most authors isn't piracy, it's obscurity. And of all the people who don't buy my book today, most of them don't buy it because they've never heard of it, not because someone gave them a free electronic copy. And I think that for novels and long-form works in general, computers are not substitutive for reasons that have to do with the affordances of using a computer, not the screen. People say, oh, well, when screens get better, everyone will read off computers. And I think this is hopelessly naive. This is like, when railroads get better, we'll put railroad tracks down every street and everyone will have their own locomotive. It's the classic fallacy of futurism, which is that the future will be like today, only more so. So I think that we read off of screens every hour we have, 18 hours a day, 20 hours a day. If the day was 30 hours long, we'd read off screens for 29 hours. So screens can't be the problem. But what we read off of screens is short. And the reason we read short things off of screens is because computers are distracting, right? And computers aren't getting less distracting. They're getting more distracting because you sit down at your computer and 5 minutes in, your IM starts jumping and then your email comes up. And then you think of something you could look up on Wikipedia and then you remember that thing you meant to Google and then you remember that you need to order some groceries. So you go to your online grocery site and oh, you forgot to check your bank balance and a million other things. And so this is why, you know, people do read books and watch full-length movies and stuff on computers on airplanes where there's no network sometimes. But where there's a network present, you need iron self-discipline. Iron self-discipline and pleasure reading are not compatible with each other. If you need iron self-discipline to have relaxation, you'll change relaxation modes. You know, the reason video games work is that they work in the context with distractions. You can be distracted with video games. So I think that when people get free electronic copies of my books, they can concentrate on it long enough to figure out whether or not they want to buy it. And it's one click away to buy it, but they can't concentrate on it long enough to read it. And when they share it with their friends, it sells more copies of the book, because there's nothing that's a more powerful tool for selling a book than being recommended to it by a friend. Much more so than a good review, much more so than even than liking a previous book by the same author. If you and I are friends and I come to you and I say, I have a book for you that you're going to love it, it's going to change your life, and I give you a copy of it, you're going to read it. In a way that if you merely see it on the shelf at a bookstore or merely read a positive review of it, you might not. And so I make it easy for friends to give friends copies of my book, even where those friends are people who've never met, because I have so many friends I've never met now, because I live on the internet.
So for you, giving away your works for free has nothing to do with idealism, or maybe a little, or like you love to give stuff away for free. It's as well like a smart marketing strategy.
There's an ideological component too. But I don't think you need ideology to understand why you should give away free electronic books. I've been giving away stuff I do for free for a long time, before the books even. I started a free software company. But the ideological intuition I have, I still don't have a nice compact definition of it. But one is that it will never get harder to copy things. And it will also only get easier to copy things, and that's good. It doesn't sound like a radical statement to say it's always going to be easier to copy things, and that's good. But there are a lot of people for whom this is like saying, I will always eat more babies, and that's good. But it's true. Computers will never get worse at copying, and the better they are at copying, the easier it is for things that are valuable to spread. And, kind of the definition of the human problem is that it's hard to lay hands on valuable things and therefore hard to distribute them in equitable ways. If things get more valuable, if the more valuable a thing is, the easier it is to copy, we move towards a better civilization. Do you know the tragedy of the commons, the British economic parable?
Yes, I know it. So, but maybe we can tell it to our listeners. It.
Sure. So in England, there were things called commons where anyone could graze their sheep. Any shepherd could graze her sheep or his sheep. And the tragedy was that from a game theory perspective, your best move was to bring your sheep and leave them there until all the grass was gone and destroy the commons. Because if you didn't, the next bastard would. And so the optimal strategy was to be a bastard first. But the internet is a commons where the sheep shit grass. Right? Where the more you graze, the more commons you get. Right? So it's not just, we say creative commons, like it's like those old commons with the sheep on them. But it's a totally different kind of commons. Remember Napster? When you download a file from Napster, you make one more copy of it available in Napster. Right? So the more popular a file is, the more widely available it becomes.
And now we see information grows by sharing.
Yeah, we see this embodied in BitTorrent much more directly now, But this is the ancient parable of the internet, is that the more value, even from, the SunSite days when we were like FTPing files around on the internet, the more valuable a file is, the more widely distributed it becomes. This is amazing. Imagine if the more delicious your food was, the more people that could eat it. There's a science fiction writer named Spider Robinson who says, when 400 people share an apple, no one benefits, especially the apple, right? But when 400 people share a file, everyone benefits, especially the file. Jared Lanier, who coined the term virtual reality, he once said that the best way to preserve information would be to embody it in cockroach DNA, because, even after a nuclear war, there'd be a billion copies of it, We actually now inhabit that world where, like, we have virtual cockroaches that propagate our ideas. It's wonderful.
So I think most people here at iCommons, they do share your argumentation, because people are used to free software and sharing, and they have their roots, in internet stuff. But how did you talk your publisher, Holzbrink, into this idea? Because often it's, like people who are grown up in these classic structures are very uncomfortable with just give it away for free.
So I was very lucky in that I had a very visionary editor. So the division of Holzbrink that I write for is Tor. They're the largest science fiction publisher in the world. And Tor is a fairly autonomous business unit within Holzbrink. And Tor's senior editor is a man named Patrick Nielsen Hayden, who I met on a bulletin board system in 1988. So he's a geek. He runs his own Linux machines. He was the first person I ever saw a tab browser on their screen. It was Patrick's computer, and he was running Conqueror, KDE, mm-hmm. you know? So he writes his own movable type plugins. He administers his own Linux machines. He uses the internet. And I said to him, Patrick, I want to share my books. And he said, you know, electronic books have had the worst ratio of hours spent in meetings to dollars generated for the publisher, right? Like, most of the time you spend an hour in a meeting, you make $1 million for the publisher. But this thing, you spend 1 million hours in the meeting, you don't even make a dollar for the publisher. Everything we've tried has been wrong. All of our attempts to do electronic publishing have been based on a priori superstition about what we think people want from their electronic books. We've never really seen what people do with electronic books in the wild. You know, and we'd both shared a kind of delight that people were pirating electronic books, science fiction novels, because science fiction is the only literature that people care enough about to steal on the internet. And, you know, as between writing the only literature that people care about enough to steal on the internet or writing a literature that people don't care enough about to steal on the internet, the former is better than the latter, right? You know, it could be worse. You could be a poet, right? No one cares about poetry enough to steal it. That's bad news for poets, right? So we said, well, why don't we do something where we can see how these books perform in the wild, right? Let's do some science, right? Let's stop making hypotheses and then acting on them as though they've been proven. Let's start making hypotheses based on observation of what happens to electronic books in the wild. And so we did it. And it worked well. We don't know how well, right? We don't have a time machine. We can't go back, publish the same book without a Creative Commons license and compare them. But it outsold their expectations. 7 printings. I can't count how many translations. I think there's a German translation of that book down in the Magic Kingdom. Pretty sure there is. And if not now, I think there's about to be one. And so translations and lots of other kind of activity around the book, and my next book sold well, and the next book sold well, and so on. And all of that was tremendous. And so all those indicators suggest that it performed well. And then the best indicator I have for it is I have a colleague whom I collaborate with on stories sometimes, and who his first novel came out around the same time as mine. And we have, you know, when critics talk about kind of a new movement in science fiction, they say me and they talk about him. So we're kind of comparable. You know, we're the same kind of writer. Our books were different, but they were the same kind of book. And the biggest difference between the books was I had CC and he didn't. And one day we sat down, we pulled out our royalty statements and we compared the numbers. And he said, your book sold a lot better than mine. And he went back to his publisher and his next book was CC based on that. So we don't have empirical quantitative studies, but we have a lot of qualitative information that suggests it. And there's now been a lot of writers who tried it, and the most convincing thing I know about this is that of all the writers who tried it, all of the ones that I know did it again. So you'd think that if it were problematic, they'd do less of it.
I think a year ago, I visited your website, craphound.com, and you had some kind of features there that, you know, people could get every day a new page of your book and stuff like that. So are you experimenting with, you know, new ways how people can enjoy books or enjoy fiction?
It's better than that. I'm not doing anything. I just put the books up and other people do stuff with them, right? I'd rather be writing. So I put the book up in 3 formats, WellFormX HTML, actually badly formed non-validating HTML, which someone then immediately downloaded and turned into WellFormX HTML for me, a PDF, just formatted for A4, you know, 8.5x11 printing easy, and ASCII text. And then I said, figure out other things to do with it. And like, it became a sport. People just sent me file format after file format after file format, Newton, PSP, you know, teletype terminal, like you name it, someone's convinced, you know, a CPM, Vong, you know, like every format in the universe, you know, people were converting it, right? And and they said, well, can we do other things with it? So these people who do a page a day email or RSS feed, they did that with it. They're about to do all of my books now as page a day email.
What is page a day email?
Like one every day you get one page. Someone just translated it all into Slovakian, everything into Slovakian. He's about to put it up, I think, next week. Someone translated it all into one of the books into Dutch last year. There's a Spanish translation on a wiki, and that it competed with a commercial Spanish translation, and there's both, you know. I mean, it's very exciting, you know. This is science, right? You do stuff, other people, you make a hypothesis. If I make this book available, people will find it more valuable in ways I don't expect. And then you evaluate the hypothesis based on experimental evidence. So instead of just doing superstition, you get to do science. It's good.
I'd like to get to a more theoretical issue. So on Wikipedia, they say that you cover the issue of post-scarcity. So what is that?
Yeah, post-scarcity.
I love the term.
Yeah. Well, that's the sheep shitting grass, right? I don't think all things are non-scarce, but I think that there is a universe of valuable things, and that universe is expanding, that increase in availability as a function of their valuableness, and where valuableness is just a proxy for popularity, right? In other words, there's our desirability. So there's a universe of things that the more desirable they are, the easier they are to get. That's a really different world to inhabit. You know, it's an amazing world to inhabit. It's a really different world to inhabit. And you know, I'm very aware of things like e-waste and all of those other problems, but it seems to me that the environmental externalities of digital goods are a lot less severe than the environmental externalities of, you know, automobiles and textiles and so on. E-waste is terrible, and the manufacturing conditions that computers and routers are made under is terrible. But that's true of all goods, and we don't need as many computers to get as much value as we need t-shirts, you know.
Do you have a master plan how to compensate creators in the future? Like, what would be your advice as well to young authors or young creators? How should they treat the media, internet?
So, do you play chess?
I played chess at the age of 6, so I'm not that good anymore.
A little, not much, and not well, and not since I was 15, 14. But one thing that always struck me about the best way to play chess, the most important thing about playing chess, was to have a lot of options. So that, because you didn't know what your opponent was going to do, right? But if you had a very flexible strategy that was very open, you could respond dynamically to changing circumstances. And eventually you'd have to commit to an end game. Right, and you'd have to play towards the end game, but you'd want to, in computer terms, you wanted this to be late binding. You know, you didn't want to be bound to a plan of action from your first move. And I think that we live in an era of unprecedented change, and our first move can't determine our next move. I have a plan for making money from my books for the next 3 years. I have never done anything for more than 3 years. Every career I've had a new career every 3 years all my life since I was 20, since I dropped out of university, 21. And every career I've gone into didn't exist when the last career started. And like no one was doing it. So it's one of the reasons I don't have a university degree, but it's also why I don't have a plan. My plan is to be flexible, so that when circumstances change, I can take advantage of them. And part of that is to learn to be happy with doing new stuff. And so it's philosophical, it's not practical. But my advice to young creators is be open to new possibilities, and also to reflect on the fact that throughout human history, the majority of creators haven't earned a living from their creation, that the most beautiful and wonderful creations we have were created by creators who are working in their spare time, that the creation of a privileged form of creativity, that, you know, the establishment of a new privileged form of creativity that belongs to creators as opposed to all of us is new. It's an artifact. It's not an eternal truth, and it won't necessarily last forever. And that if your goal is to be well compensated, don't pursue a career in the arts. And that's been good advice since the 16th century, and it's good advice in the 21st century. You have to have other goals, because the arts are not a stable way to secure your compensation. So, you know, that all said, I think that right now, the more widely available your work is, the more opportunities you have to find ways to earn money off of them, right? So you bind late. You know, you make things as widely available as possible. You keep as many options open as possible. And then when the opportunity arises, you grab it, but you don't hold on to it because the opportunity will vanish as technology moves forward. And to the extent that you're clinging to, I will make money from royalties, or I will make money from live performance, or I will make money by selling t-shirts, you are in danger of becoming, you know, blacksmiths in the era of the railroad. And, you know, there were blacksmiths who became railroad mechanics. But there were other blacksmiths who thought that by law, you know, if it was a 40-horsepower locomotive, it should have 160 horseshoes on it because, you know, 40 horses is 160 horseshoes. Those blacksmiths went broke, right? The blacksmiths who learned how to fix railroad engines, they always had work, right? Until the car came along. Then they learned how to fix cars, you know? Be prepared to change a lot. That's my master plan.
Do you know the idea of the content flat rate?
Yeah, a little bit. Not the content, the music flat rate, I know a little. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. Content flat rate, there's more research done. And
you know,
so,
Fisher,
yes, I know. And what is your opinion to that idea?
I think that is instrumentally useful. And I particularly relish the opportunity to spend a lot of time seeing what the internet can do to improve monitoring and reporting on what existing CSAC members do.
What is CSAC?
CSAC is the umbrella organization for collecting agencies like the PRO and so on, you know, and ASCAP, BMI, Harry Fox, all of these other organizations, they belong to CSAC. I think their methodologies are terrible. I think they give their members a very bad deal, and I think their organizational structures are miserable. But I think that the idea of collective licensing is attractive, and particularly if that collective licensing, if the payment into the collective licensing pool by an ISP or other provider were optional. So if an ISP could say, I'm offering the ISP that isn't legal to download music from, I'm $3 a month cheaper, and another ISP could say, come to, you know, Earthlink, it's the ISP that comes with all the music ever recorded, and we're an extra $3 a month. I think that's actually a brilliant way to differentiate ISPs. And then if the record industry thinks that it's worth their time to sue the people who join the only bandwidth ISP and then still download music, as opposed to devoting their energies to encouraging the most people possible to joining Earthlink and paying their royalties, let them do it, right? I mean, let them commit suicide, right? But I don't think that you can be successful by suing customers. You know, I like to ask a math question to record executives when I meet with them. I say, how many customers do you have to sue before the rest of them start giving you money again? Right? Is it a million customers? If you sue a million customers, will the rest of them give you money? Like, what if there's 70 million Americans who file share? Do you think if you took all of the life savings of 70 million Americans that the rest would go back to the mall and buy CDs? And, you know, when you ask it that way, they say, well, none. You know, there is no amount. The ideal number of music fans to sue to get the rest of them to buy music is minus, you know, it's negative, right? Negative lawsuits. But anytime you start suing people, I think you alienate them permanently from your business. And we all know music fans who've now been sued in America, 20,000 music fans. So I do support it. And as I say, I really support the idea of bringing commons-based peer production and open source source methodologies to monitoring and distributing these funds and analyzing statistical use of these networks. I think that that's a great alternative. And I think that we can find lots of great actuarial methods for auditing how these networks are used. Right now, we fetishize actual accounting. You know, we want to know exactly which song is being downloaded by which person at what time in what country. You know, banks don't work that way. Banks work on actuarial tables. You know, insurance works on actuarial tables. Gambling works on actuarial tables. They're much bigger industries than music, right? The actual accounting is it's an illusion, right? My publisher, they give me these very neat sheets of paper that say we printed so many books, we sold so many books, and so on. They're guessing, right? This is plus or minus 1,000, you know? Nobody knows to the unit. And in fact, the more fluid this stuff, because we used to think that the more digital it was, the more countable it was. And it's true that digits are easier to count than atoms. But what we lost track of is that the more digital something is, the more fluid it is. And the more fluid something is, the harder it is to count.
I have one last question. Okay, here at the iCommons Summit, everyone talks about the free culture movement. Uh-huh. So what is your attitude to that term? Does that exist, free culture movement? Is it useful to talk like that or to have that attitude?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think that there is a free culture movement. And I think, like all good movements, no one knows what it means. Right? Well, like, so, you know, if human rights meant what Amnesty says human rights is, then the human rights movement wouldn't be a movement. It would be Amnesty. If environmentalism meant what the Green Party says it was, then it wouldn't be a movement. It would be the Green Party. The difference between a group and a movement is whether or not you have a bunch of people who have a comparable objective or set of confluent objectives, but not all objectives identical, who all work together more or less when it suits their needs, while individually possibly not liking each other very much, but who pull in the same direction when it suits them.
What is your website again, your address?
I have a few, craphound.com, C-R-A-P-H-O-U-N-D, and boingboing.net.
Thank you very much, and good luck with your work as a copyright reformer, and I look forward to your next book. Thank you.
Thank you. Vielen Dank.